the American Revolution podcast, episode 54, Chaining the Hudson. So this is going to be the self-titled episode where we look at the last type of river fortifications on the Hudson River during the Revolutionary War. Now, we've gone over a lot of different types of fortifications, and I'm going to do just a quick brief overview of each one so we just have a better, clearer understanding as to what we've already talked about. The first river fortification that we were talking about was Roman's proposed fort, a huge complex on Martelitos Rock on the Hudson, round about the area that the future West Point will be. Now, the complex and the idea that was laid out was looked like a fortified position that could be held at least decently well. The only problem is that funding ran out. And that wasn't really a surprise that the project has to be abandoned. Now, something that I didn't really go over, and that I'm just going to address now, is that Fort Constitution was Roman's fort. And the fact that whatever was there, whatever limited type of fortifications were there, were utilized as a defensive position until better positions can be made. After that, we started talking about Bushnell Sub. Started about the same time as Roman's fort, Bushnell Sub was going to be America's first attempt at using underwater warfare. And it's actually the first time in the world history, military history, that we'll ever see the use of a underwater vessel as a way of destroying enemy ships. So this was definitely an interesting concept. The problem is that it was still in its infancy, the technology. And though it was executed, at least to some extent, properly, it really didn't have the desired effect. And I think that's more so because the technology just wasn't there. The torpedo technology wasn't there. And we'll see that torpedo technology and the way a submarine operated would improve at no longer than 80 years later when the Confederate States of America put out the Hunley. So we talked about the turtle. Then we started talking about the use of chevaux de frise and their significance. And I think I did these a little bit out of order, but I think it was more so because of the fire ships we were talking about happened later in the war, and the chevaux de frise were happening earlier. I think just the timing. The chevaux de frise are put into place during July and August of 1776, right around just before the Battle of Brooklyn. Because as the British ships arrive, they have to figure out a way to block this. They have two forts that are being built, but they wanted to use something to hang the ships up, so they resorted to chevaux de frise, which had been put into the Delaware River and were effective. But in the Hudson, due to the tides and everything, they were not. And as I went from chevaux de frise, I had moved on to talking about Polapel Island, and how Schuyler had put the type of fortification in place there. And I'll talk about why we kind of skipped ahead to Polapel Island, and it's going to kind of link the story together. Then we started discussing the Stirling's beacon system and fire ships. Now, the beacon system was put in place even before forts were proposed. That was one of the first things that was put, was we had to find a warning system in case British ships arrive. When the British ships arrive, we expanded the beacon system to spread out to the entire coastline, because now the British ships are here, they could land anywhere. And then we started talking about fire ships, and because the fire ships were being put into place or being used right after the chevaux de frise, I kind of lined those up. So we had ended last week talking about the fire ships, and now we're into the discussion about the chains. And like everything else, we're kind of I feel that each fortification has its own story, and that's the way I'm kind of doing it. Each episode is its own story, and they're not going to interconnect, because if the chevaux de frise had worked on the Hudson, I don't think the chain would go into place. Had the fire ships worked, maybe the British Navy wouldn't have stayed in the New York area as long as they did. Had Bushnell Sub worked, who knows what the outcome could have been. So because each story is individualized, That's kind of where I'm at now. And I know that over these episodes, it's been confusing, and I'm really sorry about that. But as we're talking about these river fortifications, I want everyone to understand that each of these units that I've put in here, I'm trying to individualize them. Whereas for the previous 50 episodes, I've been talking about a story, and every week was adding to that story a new chapter. Here, this is kind of a standalone, like the bonus episodes, it's kind of a standalone chapter, just talking about the Hudson River defenses as a one solid unit. So, where we are now is we are looking just after Lexington and Concord. Major Christopher Tappan, Colonel James Clinton were part of a secret committee for the Hudson River defenses. We have talked about this. After Lexington and Concord, the first thing that the New York colonies do, even before they start raising militias, is the fact that they are now worried about, well, what do we do about the Hudson River? We have one of the largest rivers on the East Coast with one of the most and it's also one of the most traveled rivers as far as trade goes. What do we do to protect this river? So the secret committee is formed very early in 1775. Well, Clinton had stated early on that if they were could construct a chain and boom system, that could possibly block the Hudson of any vessel. Now, for centuries, man had used cordage or chains to protect ships from being cut adrift. The Greeks and Romans used chains to anchor their ships because they knew that if an enemy got into the water, they would be able to cut the cordage and their ships would suddenly float away. But if you use chain, they couldn't be hand cut. The Egyptians used, as far back as the time of the Egyptian Empire and the pharaohs and all of that, to protect their ports against enemies, they used thick hemp cording. They were using thick rope as a way to deter enemy vessels from getting into their port. They would get hung up on the rope, and that would give the army or other vessels time to intervene before an enemy ship could get into their port. So this isn't a new concept, the use of chains or a boom system that would be used to block the Hudson River. So in the summer of 1775, the question became, could a chain and boom system stop a British warship, even a small frigate like the HMS Phoenix? Well, work is finally halted on Fort Constitution, Roman's Fort, in early 1776. It's decided that they're going to create two new fortifications. And these two new fortifications, would be built along the banks of a tributary of the Hudson River, and I'm going to destroy the name, Papillion Creek. The Fort Montgomery would be going on the north side of the creek, while on the south side, they were going to build the future Fort Clinton. Now, Fort Montgomery would be christened in April of 1776 in honor of the late Richard Montgomery. Fort Montgomery is also the location of the proposed chain system that would be used to block the Hudson River. The only problem was that much timber that would be needed for the boons that would hold the chain up were unavailable. So they unfortunately had to begin to shift their thinking. Now, remember, the boons that would hold the chain up would have to be thick lumber. It would have to be straight lumber. You can't create a boom system with trees that are crooked. So they had to be long, straight, thick trees that would hold this chain up. And remember, it's got to hold up a lot of weight. Now, why would the chain have to be held up? And that is a question I know a lot of people would ask. Why would the chain stay above the water? The thought process was if you put a chain in the water, a chain's going to sink. Iron in the water is going to sink. It would be a lot easier for a ship to go over the chain, especially if slack could be created enough to where the ship could get over the top of the chain. Now, also, running water on what is at the time going to be wrought iron, it's going to rust it. How long can that chain be in the water where a ship, with it getting wet and everything, rust is going to take its toll on it. a ship could actually break through weaknesses in the links that are created from rust. So these are all things they have to consider. So that's why we see this shift into the chevaux de frise at Fort Lee and Fort Washington. But it's never wholly abandoned. You see, they're going to actually create a chain system that they're going to send to Canada. You see, General Lee was very interested in the idea of using a chain. And he had one built in upstate New York. Now, it's destined to go to Canada to protect the Northern Army from Canadian warships along the areas of the Richelieu River. But with the deteriorating situation in Canada, the chain will be sent from the north ahead of the retreating army and end up at Fort Ticonderoga. In July, the secret committee will send word to General Schuyler that the chain should be sent back to Poughkeepsie. The chain would have to be extended to meet the requirements of that portion of the Hudson River, but by October, the chain was nearing its completion. You have to remember that the chain has to be made really thick to prevent a ship from being able to just break it. Now, you're not going to use something like a bike chain. You know, a good-sized warship can break through a thin chain. The chain estimates for Fort Montgomery were that the links, the metal bars that they bent to create each link, were over an inch and a half thick. So that is a good size thickness of chain that is going to be run across the Hudson River. So this is going to take time. It takes time to create the ingots, then to pound out each link, and then you have to fold each link and connect it to the next portion of the chain. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. And so by October, the chain is getting real close to being done. Now, there's someone at Fort Montgomery that we haven't talked about. This is a man that his name will become synonymous with other parts of the war, but I'm going to, you know, give you the little introduction to him now. And that's Lieutenant Thomas Machen. He is an Army engineer that was working on preparing the anchoring points for the chain and would be the one who kind of leads the placement of the chain at Fort Montgomery. Now, Machen is born in England on March 20th, 1744 in Staffordshire. At the age of 15, he will enter into military service. He will see action in the continent during the Seven Years' War. Remember, that's the French and Indian War. After the war, he will leave the military service and become a surveyor. He was actually sent to America to survey copper deposits in northern New Jersey. By 1772, Machen had moved to Boston and was caught up in all the excitement of the Sons of Liberty. He had actually taken part in the Boston Tea Party. And when the war came in spring of 1775, he will join the cause and will actually fight at Bunker Hill and is injured. Once he's fully recovered, though, he joins the Continental Army in the very beginning of 1776 as a second lieutenant. He'll actually help Henry Knox put the guns in place on Dorchester Heights. So impressed with the young man's skill, Washington leaves him in Boston, reluctantly, of course, to help with the fortification of the canals and channels around the city. But he won't be there for long because as we enter the summer of 1776, Machen is called to New York, where he is immediately sent to the Highlands to assist with defenses around Forts Montgomery and Constitution. So as we fast forward to October of 1776, the chain is almost done, and Machen calls for the boons to be floated down from Poughkeepsie. So with the boons coming in, the chain will actually go into the water in the first week of November of 1776. Now, I will have to remind everyone that the Hudson River is a tidal waterway. So it is, even as far as Fort Montgomery into upstate New York, into the Highlands, there is still that current that rushes in and out when the tides roll in and out in the bay. So not more than a day of the chain being in the water, the pressure from the outgoing tide breaks the chain. It was like the air went out of the committee, the Congress, and Continental leadership collectively. This was their one good hope. And the committee began to panic. The chain was their chance of stopping the British from moving up and trying to take over Albany. And with winter setting in, they had to do something. Now, we talked about this. This is where Polapel Island's chevaux de frise come into place. Because if with the chain not being in place and ready to go, they needed a secondary defense against British warships getting up into going towards Albany. So this is where we see that chevaux de frise at Polopol Island. A little footnote when we were talking about the Fort Washington chevaux de frise, but it was something I wanted to point out. I said the failure of the Fort Montgomery chain. This is what I meant. With the Fort Montgomery chain failing, that's why they set up the Polopol Island chevaux de frise. But they still really want the chain to work, so they start to brainstorm. Winter is setting in. Luckily, the ships won't be coming up too far because once the ice sets in, we're okay. So what do we do? Well, Schuyler had offered a suggestion. What if they could sink the chain just below the surface and attach it to caissons? This way, it's hidden and it won't be on top of the water with the rushing tide. It'll be just below the surface. At least that's what his thinking is. Machen still believes that the chain and the boom system was the best way to go. At an impasse, the commander-in-chief will turn to his chief engineer, Rufus Putnam. Putnam will actually ask Machen for a sketch of the river to help him and Washington make a decision. And after a couple of days, after Machen sends the sketch to Washington, it's decided that the chain and boom system is going to go forward, and so Machen is authorized to fix the chain. So with winter just about to set in, he tows in the chain and boons up into Papillion Creek. By the end of this episode, I should get the name of that creek right, Papillion Creek, so that the weak links could be replaced and the chain could be ready to be reset in the spring. Well, that's what they do, working hard through the winter. There are some issues with workmanship and money, as there always is, but they get the chain done, and by the spring of 1777, the chain was placed, and this time it held. It held so well that the British had to come north at some point and try and take possession of the forts that were protecting the chain. You see, but the interesting thing about this is that they actually stopped before the chain, landed their troops. The troops assaulted Fort Clinton and Fort Montgomery and will never directly assault the chain because they knew they couldn't get past it. They were that confident in Machen's design that they felt that this was going to be an impassable defense. So we're going to talk about the fight for the chain in a later episode because this is now we're now talking 1777-78. So we're jumping really ahead. But the Fort Montgomery chain was holding, and it was doing its job. But the Fort Montgomery chain would be temporary, because with the Fort Montgomery chain in place, Machen took his skills and made a larger chain further upriver. Now, West Point is something that we've mentioned multiple times in multiple episodes, and I even said at the beginning of this episode. West Point is today known as a military college. But as I have said, it during the Revolution, it was a key fort on the Hudson River to protect against the British from heading north and taking possession of Albany. The British will get really desperate and will have to utilize even Continental men in their attempt to take over this fort. Luckily, it never happens, and the Fort Washington and Fort And the fort at West Point, there we go, the fort at West Point will never be taken. Part of the reason the British want the fort at West Point so bad is, one, it's a very good defensive position in the Highlands. But the next point of it was that Machen had built a second chain, a bigger chain, a better chain. This chain and boom system was the only thing that was keeping the British off the Hudson River and heading up into Albany. This chain was the chain they needed to take over, and they never could. So the West Point chain would be the chain that would finally defend the Hudson River. Now, in these courses of these episodes, we have talked a lot about the types of river defenses and how they failed, how each one met with failure. And it's not until this point that when we get to talk of an actual chain being run across the Hudson River that we are seeing real success. Yes, the Fort Montgomery chain in the very beginning didn't work, but that was because they had to account for the stress that the chain would be on in the rushing current. When Machen makes the West Point chain, that chain is far thicker and was made in such a way that it could stand up to that incoming tide and outgoing tide. So the current never affected the chain. And that chain will hold until 1781. But were the other defenses real failures? No. The answer is no. I'm going to tell you that outright. The Turtle was the first ever combat submarine that will be put into place. This was way ahead of its time. The technology just wasn't there. Roman's fort was just another fort. It was a good fort, but you didn't have the money to build such a complex. So, unfortunately, the design is good, but the complex was just too expensive. Okay. Chevaux de Frise have proven themselves on many different rivers. And it's a proven defensive work in several different places. And when we start talking about battles around the Philadelphia area, there will be a discussion where the Chevaux de Frise are a key player in the fight for the defense of the Delaware River. So we know the Chevaux de Frise work. They don't work on the Hudson. The Hudson is a tidal river. It's a very fast current. It's also very deep, which is why trading along the Hudson River has persisted for hundreds of years. Even to this day, you see ships that go way up into the Hudson, up into Albany, and even farther now because of a lock system that's been put in place to bring goods as far north as they possibly can, almost into Canada. So now, the Hudson River is not the place for Chevaux de Frise. What about the fireships? The fireships is a concept that's been used in military for generations. But the fireships are used by men. Men can make mistakes. And because man is fallible, the fireships are also fallible. The one congruent thing that had stood the test of time and stood through the entire war, or at least for its time in the war, was the chains at Fort Montgomery and Fort West Point. These chains were proven to stand up and to defend the river against the British. So though river defenses may not have worked on the Hudson, they have worked in many other places. And to say that these are a failure is not a accurate historical assessment, because there is many cases where they have worked elsewhere. And though the only exception would be the Turtle, because it is a singular case, it is proven that men could travel underwater in a submersible. It is just the fact that you have to try and affix a torpedo to the hull of a ship that proves difficult. That technology is still years behind. And we'll see in the Civil War with the Hunley that that technology got better. So the chaining the Hudson is quite literally the best way to go about it when you ever want – if you ever want to protect the Hudson River, is to literally lay a chain across of it. This series of episodes was a lot of fun. The interesting thing about this book, Chaining the Hudson, once again, it's a book I recommend if – I know I've put it on the Facebook. I hope some people have looked for it. But Chaining the Hudson, The Fight for the River in the American Revolution by Lincoln Diamant. I think I pronounced his name right. Forgive me. I'm very terrible at pronouncing difficult names. Is definitely it was one I wanted to do because this was one of the first books that I bought when I started working at the Saratoga National Historical Park. Now, oh my goodness, it's been 6 years. It feels like a different lifetime ago, but when I was up there, this was one of the first books I bought. And it interested me greatly because it pertained a lot to where I was working, and it opened up all kinds of discussions. And the interesting thing is, people don't realize the importance of the Hudson River during the American Revolution. It goes back to one of my first episodes where we talk about the American Revolution, and it for a lot of people it seems like we fight Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill. There's little space in between, so we just assume the battles happened right after one another. And then the war starts, Washington crosses the Delaware at some point, and then we all of a sudden are in Yorktown, and then the war's over. There are all these pieces that are missed out in social studies curriculums nowadays that I thought this would be an interesting set of episodes, and I was going to do it. I was always going to do it, but that's why I kind of asked you guys what you would want to hear about. And the overwhelming responses, I think everyone that had answered the poll that I put on the Facebook about what is our next step wanted to know about the river fortifications, probably because they had never heard of it. And that was something that made me very happy is, one, there's a lot of people using the Facebook. That's a big thing. And two, they were generally interested in a new topic that they probably have never heard. And at least I hope that's the case for some people. Others may have might know the stories, and we're just looking to see what I knew about the stories. I'm going to end this episode on two last points. Number one, this was a very difficult group of episodes to do because I'm only talking about the river fortifications. And when you read the book, you're going to be like, well, why didn't you talk about this? Why didn't you talk about that? It's because when, one, doing these episodes, I didn't want to make them a overwhelming, deeply thematic look into every little individual thing that went into the creation of these river defenses. I just kind of wanted to make it very loose, fact-based, something that it just was an overall look at this type of river defense and what it did for the Americans and how it worked or how it didn't work, so on and so forth. I also didn't want to edge like we kind of did with this episode into future contexts that we're not going to talk about yet. And when you take that context out of its timeline, it can get a little confusing. So I try to make it as easy as possible. So I would say that was one of the key concerns of doing this group of episodes was the fact that I wasn't sure how they would be perceived. Because I'm kind of just yanking them out of the context and not fitting them in with the timeline to preserve the timeline that we're going to talk about, I guess is what I'm kind of getting at there. So sorry if that, you know, one thing is a little confusing. The last point I'm going to end on is that after this, we are now going to move into the Northern Department. We're going back north. So we're going to actually hit the rewind button, and we're going to go all the way back to January of 1776. So be prepared. We ended in December of 1776 with Washington, and we had discussed everything that was going on with him. Now we are going to hit the rewind button, head all the way back to January, and move ourselves forward. The next grouping of episodes is going to be all about what happens in the Northern Department and what's going on with the Army up there until the end of 1776. Now, this will actually be I have one more episode that I'm planning to do, hopefully on Monday. But next week, Monday will be the day that my niece and nephew are coming for the week for the 4th of July. It will also be – at the end of that week will be the second anniversary of the podcast. I started the podcast 2 years ago, and I do have to really kick myself in the pants because there has been large gaps of time in between each episode. But now that I've really got a firm footing, I've gotten used to all this, we're actually rolling at a good pace. So next on Monday, I will be putting out an episode. It is going to be an overview and just a reminder to get ourselves in the mindset of talking about what happened in the North that brings us now to the January of 1776 and what we're going to be talking about from there on. It won't be an overly long episode. It's just going to be me just reminding everyone what happened with the Army up there and how we got to that point. So this is going to do it for this week. I'm really excited to get my next set of episodes in. So after Monday's episode, unfortunately, I will be out for a week. Hopefully in that time frame, I will be able to get a good amount of episodes put into the computer. This way, I have a nice bank of episodes to pull from so I can keep on track with everything. Also, I need a couple extra days because with my niece and nephew coming, I gotta spend time with them. So, as always, I hope everyone has a great week. And more importantly, have a great 4th of July. Whatever your traditions are on the 4th of July, make sure you get out there and do it. At least on the East Coast, it looks like we're going to have a good 4th of July. I hope everyone else is having good weather during their 4th. So until about 2 weeks from now, everyone have a good, safe holiday. And as always, keep that powder dry.